This is Cave Scott Allen of OTCO.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
Hello and welcome to Herding Code. This episode is being recorded on April 4th, 2013, and we are in Copenhagen, and I'm talking to Mark Seaman. So I saw your talk the other day in Horsens, and I heard people laughing, and I thought the slides looked pretty neat, but I couldn't understand a word. So,
yeah, it wasn't Danish.
It wasn't Danish, yes. I did understand a few words every now and then, like you would say, you know, test or something.
Yes.
But, yeah. So let's start with AutoFixture.
Okay.
Tell me what that does.
So AutoFixture is an open source library that I've been working on for a couple of years. And what it does is it simplifies all the setup code that you typically would have to do in your unit test. So if you think about your basic arrange, act, assert sort of unit tests, the arrange part often takes up much more space than the other two parts for lots of people. And the reason for that is that you have to get a lot of things set up and actually create a lot of different variables in order to have all this stuff that you need to actually, you know, invoke in your test.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Is this where anonymous variables comes in?
Yes. So the whole terminology is something that I lifted from a book called XUnit Test Patterns by Gerard Maseros. He has this huge book of, you know, I think it's about 800 pages, which is pretty much a pattern book about how do you write good unit tests.
Okay.
So that's a very recommendable book. I really love that book. But he has this whole terminology around anonymous methods and anonymous variables, which basically tries to indicate that we want an instance of some sort of object, but we don't really care about the specific content of that instance. We just want some instance of it.
Okay.
Because otherwise the test is not going to compile.
Okay.
So we often have APIs where we need a little bit of setup before we can actually invoke the method that we actually want to test. We want to, you know, you have to create an instance of that class and so on.
Okay, so maybe a method that does something with a user class. So then I need to create a user and
you need to create
set up all the necessary.
Yes. Okay. So there's this pattern called the test data builder pattern, which is described by, I have to give credits where credits are due. I think it was Nat Price, one of the authors of Growing Object-Oriented Software Guide by Tests. He describes this nice pattern called the test data builder pattern, which uses this fluent builder API style where you can just specify which parts of the test data or your system under test that you actually care about. And all the other things that you don't really care about will just fall back and have some good default values.
Okay. So for instance, maybe like a something about an order and I'm only testing a specific thing about the price or whatever. And I don't care what the item name is,
exactly.
But it's required.
Yes, okay. Exactly. So I used that test data builder pattern for some time. And the thing about the test data builder pattern is that it's very easy to understand, but it also gets to be very mechanical in the way that you have to implement a test data builder in this specific way. And it's test specific code that you have to write and you have to maintain that. So I just thought that it's a very nice pattern, but there's a lot of overhead involved in actually maintaining all that unit test code. It's not very complicated. It has, you know, a very low cyclomatic complexity, but still that's just a lot of code you need to maintain. So I thought, could we possibly, you know, automate this? Because it seems like a very mechanical thing.
Okay.
So that's basically what I ended up doing with AutoFixture. Then I thought that, well, yeah, we can probably do some reflection over the things that we want to create. So instead of having to build a test specific test data builder class around each thing we wanted to test, maybe we could just reflect over it and create the instances as needed. So that's basically how AutoFixture got started.
Okay. So in order to use it, I would create an instance of the fixture.
You would create an instance of the fixture class. Yes. And then it has some basic creation method. So you can just say create, and it's a generic method. So you said create string or create my foo object or whatever, and you just get an instance of that back.
Now, I noticed that it's not just returning something random or empty strings, for instance. Like if I get a string, I'll get like a unique ID, or if I get an integer, then I'll get sequential integers.
We actually changed that in the new release that's out here. So AutoFixture 3 came out a couple of months ago, I think now. So we used to have this idea about just doing sequential integers for integers, but then we had basically GUID, new GUID two string for strings, for example.
Right.
So a string would always be unique. So we wanted to make that a little bit more consistent. So we actually changed the algorithm for doing numbers now so that it actually picks a random number, a random small number. So that's something that typically tends to scare people a little bit away from autofixes sometimes, because they say, well, I don't want my unit tests to be non-deterministic because, right. You know, you've read that, you know, non-deterministic unit tests are bad. And I totally agree that that's, you know, a really non-deterministic unit test is not something that you want.
Yeah.
But the idea behind autofixture is something that builds on a concept called equivalence class or equivalence set. And that's now this is beginning to sound a little bit highbrow, but basically what it does is that an equivalence class is the, or an equivalence set is the set of values, input values that sits between two boundary cases, if you will.
Okay.
So if you imagine a simple, let's say a simple class that, you know, does something if an input number is less than 10, and it does something else if the input is greater than 10, just to say that. So obviously we have a boundary condition that sits at the number 10.
Right.
So you could say that any number between 0 and 10, or any number, less than 10, even negative numbers, would fall into the same equivalence set because they would exercise the same path through the code.
Yeah.
And any number above 10 would exercise a different path through the code. So that would be a different equivalence class, if you will. So that's just... that's actually a pretty basic test theory, if you will. So the assumption in autofixture is that if you want a number, for example, we make a guess. So this is like the Pareto principle, this 80-20 principle
right,
here.
Right.
We say we would probably guess that in most cases, if we give you any positive small number, that would probably fall into the same equivalence class. So if I gave you 42 or if I gave you 37, that would probably not change the behavior of your system under test in most cases anyway.
Okay.
So that's the assumption anyway. So we start out by giving you a random number between 1 and 255, because that's something that fits into a byte. So even if you're just asking for, you know, the data type byte, we actually give you something that fit into that data type.
Okay.
So that's not always the case. So that's just the assumption that in most cases, a number would be, you know, it wouldn't really matter whether you're talking about the number 101 or, you know, 42.
Right.
In some cases, it does, because that might be a loop counter or anything else. So you might not want to use autofixer to generate that number for you, because that number actually has, you know, a very specific influence on the behavior. So the idea about autofixer is that it should, you know, you can use it for everything where you don't care about the value.
Okay.
So if you're actually writing a unit test where that value is important for how you would expect the outcome of your test to be, you wouldn't use autofixer to generate that part of, you know, your input data. But then for everything else, you can use autofixer,
okay,
because you're basically just saying, I don't care, and I expect, you know, everything to just fall into the correct equivalence set. And then you can configure autofixer to your heart's content if you don't like the defaults that we have.
Okay, so let's say, for instance, I have you know, an order class, and I don't care about what the product is, but I do care very specifically about maybe the discount percent or something.
Yes.
Like that. And I want to set, you know, I want to set that number specifically.
Yes.
And so how would I, can I use autofixture to create the order and say just the discount percent is one amount?
That there are various ways that you can do that. So one of the things that most people start to do when they start using autofixture is that we have a little fluent syntax. So you could say fixture.build order, and that would give you now a fluent syntax where, using a lambda expression, you could say with, and then you could say x over in, you know, arrow over in x dot
right,
discount percentage, and set that to a specific value then.
Okay.
So that would actually be an expression of order that, you know, enables you to, or gives you compile time safety into that you have referenced in a very specific property, and then you provide the value for that property as well. So that's something you can do. And then when you've done with all the things that you want to configure, you can just say, you know, dot create, and then it'll actually create you an instance of order that fits into all those constraints that you actually told it to. So that's actually more or less the test data builder pattern.
Okay.
Action just as a general purpose API, if you will.
So a lot of the time I've seen where, you know, when you're setting up test data, you run into problems where, you know, maybe the order requires then some, you've got other dependencies and some things that are difficult to mock.
Yes.
Or whatever. So do you interface with other mocking frameworks, or do you get into the mocking business?
So we don't get into the mocking business ourselves, because we think that there are mocking frameworks that are excellent at what they do already. Mm-hmm. But what we do provide is we do provide some glue libraries, if you will. So those are separate projects that you can pull down from NuGet. And you can just say, I want to use AutoFixture and I want to turn AutoFixture into an auto-mocking container using, for example, mock.
Okay.
And then you just pull that one down and that there's a little, you have to write one line of code that just tells AutoFixture that it should pull in this specific extension, if you will. And then it's going to do that. And we have glue libraries for mock with Q and for RhinoMox and for Fake It Easy and for InSubstitute.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, I should have been using this a long time ago. Okay, so that's kind of the overview of what it does.
Mm-hmm.
You were talking, there was similarities and equivalents, and there were some really interesting slides that you had that I didn't really... Was there a deeper level on that equivalence and similarities?
Oh, so one of the things that I was talking about in this talk that I have here at the conference is that I spend about half that talk talking about identity, because I think one of the things that are really interesting when you start unit testing is that when you get to the verification phase, the assert phase in the arrayed act assert terminology, when you get to that phase, what you very often do is that you say, I expect a specific outcome. This is the state of the whole system that I expect to be the outcome. And then you compare that to what actually happened. Mm-hmm. So basically what you're saying is the expected state equal to the actual state? And I think it's often interesting that even though that's what you want to do, you often end up writing a lot of, you know, very detailed assert equal that. And, you know, you have lots of assertion statements, but often what you really care about is just to say, here's what I expect. Here's what actually happened. Are those two equal to each other? So one of the things that I talk about here in this talk is how you can think about identity and both make that influence how you actually design your API, because lots of cases it might actually make sense to say, what if I override the equals method on the thing that I want to compare in such a way that, you know, my unit test is just going to be a single assert equal expected actual. And that often makes a lot of sense, particularly if you work with something called a value object. So now I'm pulling in some terminology from a book called Domain Driven Design by Eric Evans. And not that you have to think about domain driven design itself, but it has this categorization of how you can think about objects, where basically you talk about entities, which is something that has an ID that we tend to store in a database. And then we have something called value object, which is a pattern that's, you know, money. A money object is probably the most common example of that. So you have something that represents, you know, $100. And the beautiful thing about a value object is that if you have two instances that represent $100, if you try to compare those, you would probably say, yes, those are actually equal. So it makes a lot of sense to just override the equals method on anything that's a value object and say, you know, if all the constituent fields inside of that object are equal, then they are equal.
So for instance, with a money type, then you've got the amount, you also have the currency and maybe some other things associated, right? So the overriding equals checks that all of those things are the same.
Yeah, that would make sense, because you would say that, you know, $100 is equal to $100, but $100 is not equal to 100 Danish kroner, for example.
Yeah.
Or, you know, if you change the amount as well, that would also make them not equal. So the typical implementation for a value object would be that all the fields have to match. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise they're not really equal to each other. But it just turns out that if you can model a lot of your object model, the API that you're trying to test, the more of that you can model as value objects, the easier the tests become to write, or the easier it becomes to verify that the expected is actually the expected outcome and the actual outcome actually matches. That just becomes almost trivial then.
So this gets back to the common thing that a huge value of test-driven development is that it's going to drive you towards a better design anyways, right?
Yeah. So you definitely get feedback on how could the system under test be easier to test. And it often turns out that if you make it easier to test, you just make it easier to work with in overall.
Yeah.
So that's my experience anyway. You still need to have all your skill set. You actually have to apply all your skill set, all the things you know about, you know, proper object-oriented design or functional programming or whatever you want to apply to whatever you're doing. You still have to do that. But test-driven development gives you a little bit of feedback saying that, well, this test was too difficult to write.
Right.
Maybe that tells me something about, could I model this system under test part of the code in a different way to make that test a little bit easier to write.
Okay.
So that's where I am at the moment. So I was a couple of years back, I was actually trying out just for fun to see whether this whole idea about test-driven design, you know, just using the tests to drive your design, whether that actually worked out or not. But I actually found out that, you know, if I blindly just let my tests, you know, drive the implementation.
Yeah.
I ended up with something that was, it was very loosely coupled and obviously it was very testable, but it wasn't very cohesive. It wasn't very easy to reason about. And,
right.
you know, you just had lots of interfaces everywhere. And, you know, anyone else who came and visited that code base afterwards would go and say, huh? What
right.
does this do? How do I work with this?
So testability is an important input, but it's not the only important
yeah,
input.
Yeah. So I went back to that and I rethought that and I thought, well, TDD for me now just means test driven development. So I still do TDD, but it doesn't have a design. Mm-hmm. You know, design is not the forefront thing. It's not the first, how can I say this? It's not the first thing that I think about when I think about TDD. For me, TDD is a feedback process. So I still think about the design of the code that I want to drive forward. I still think about that upfront.
Mm-hmm.
But instead of doing big design upfront, I just, you know, think a little bit ahead at a time. And then I write some tests to actually, you know, to verify, does this actually make sense? You know, does this fit what I thought it would do? You know, and let that inform me whether I'm moving in the right direction or not.
So as we're talking about that, that reminds me of some recent posts that you'd written about testing trivial methods.
Yes.
So can you explain the thinking behind that?
So what actually triggered that thing, and maybe I should have thought more before I actually posted my post, but anyway, what triggered that was that Robert C. Martin, or Uncle Bob as mm-hmm. he's also known, wrote a blog post where he said that, you know, even though he often comes across as being very dogmatic, he says, well, I am actually pragmatic. And then he came up with some examples where he was pragmatic and he said, well, it's not necessary to do test-driven development on certain parts of your code anyway. Mm-hmm. And I think some of the examples that he gave made a lot of sense to me. But then he also said, he was talking about getter and setter methods because you don't have properties in Java and the languages
right.
that he usually use. But he was saying that, well, getter and setter methods, he didn't really test those because he thought that those were so trivial that wasn't really very important and they would be indirectly tested anyway.
Okay.
And I just thought that was, I have no problem with people being pragmatic at all, but it's just that a lot of the other advice that Robert C. Martin tends to give is very well-founded and he has a lot of arguments of why would you want to do that and why wouldn't you want to do certain things. But this just came out of the blue and wasn't really very, very well-founded in argument, I think. So
yeah.
I just wanted to you know, talk about that aspect and figure out, so what sort of principles would we apply in order to figure out whether we should test getters and setters or properties, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So the real point that I really had was that if you decide to have a getter and a setter or a property in .NET, that would often be because you have made, or it should be because you have made a conscious design decision to say, I am going to encapsulate some values that this object holds into some sort of getter setter method.
Right, right.
Instead of just having, you know, a public field.
Yes.
So some people were provoked by this because they
yeah.
thought that was just, you know, TDD navel-gazing, I think
okay.
some people said, which was never really my point. But my point was more that, you know, a lot of the things that I like about the TDD process is that it should force you to think and question everything, more
yeah.
or less. So my point here is more that when you want to add a property to your class, you should have two questions here. Do I need to test this or not? But rather, why am I actually adding a property instead of just a field? And mm. sometimes you might as well just add a field because you may be building code that's, you know, what I call enterprise code, which is not necessarily a bad term, but I'm just thinking about enterprise code as something that where you have a lot of control about the entire life cycle of the
yeah.
application. So you're building the code for your own enterprise and you're deploying it into the enterprise's data centers and so on. And if you ever need to change something, you can go through a process where you actually control everything because the code is not running in the wild. It's running in your enterprise. So you can make breaking changes and that's probably going to work for you anyway. So, you know, making a breaking change is not, doesn't have a huge cost.
Mm-hmm.
So in that case, the question is, you know, is a property really necessary at all? Wouldn't a field, you know, be just as good? But on the other hand, if you're building software that needs to go into the wild, you know, thousands of people download it and use it and you don't have any control of where that actually goes, you know, introducing a breaking change to your code becomes a very, very big deal.
Yeah.
So at that point, I think that, you know, if you decide to add a property to your code base, you also want to test that property actually maintains the behavior that it originally had.
I see.
Even if that behavior is just as simple as, you know, just returning the value that you originally sit on it.
Because you've said that having a property is important to you.
Yes.
And later you may change the behavior of that property, the getters or setters.
So I think that a lot of the flame wars that come out of blog posts, and, you know, sometimes I'm involved in them and sometimes I'm just watching from the sideline.
Yeah.
I think that they actually originate in that people sit there and have various different contexts that they think about.
Yeah.
You know, and some people build applications where they do control the entire life cycle of that application, and they say that, you know, you don't have to be very rigid about those things because you can just change those things.
Right.
And I completely get that. I mean, that makes a lot of sense to me. So in that case, it, you know, it's probably not important if you have 100% code coverage. You can probably get by with a lot less.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, you have some other types of code where, you know, you have to be more rigid about it because, you know, it really has a big impact if you break stuff.
So how does this shake out with something like, I've seen arguments about ASP.NET MVC controller code.
Mm-hmm.
And originally I know it was designed so that you could test your controllers, but then people said, what's the point in, you know, a good controller should be very thin.
Yes.
You should just, you know, be calling off to other testable services.
Yes.
But your controller itself should do very little.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm assuming that based on what you've said earlier, that you probably would lean to the side of writing tests around even a you know, rather trivial controller.
Yes.
Just because it may change later.
So I'm in the habit of writing tests for almost everything that I produce, but that's also just a habit because that's what I, you know, learned when I originally learned myself, taught myself test-driven development. That's what I did. So I've come up with a lot of different tools to address some of the problems where you could say, well, I don't want to write all of that, you know, test because, you know, writing the test is more work than writing the actual thing. Then I said, well, let's automate that. And that's also why tools like AutoFixture and so on actually exist. But there are other ways into that where you can say, well, this is trivial, so I don't want to unit test this because I'll just, you know, concentrate on what's important. And I think that's an equally valid approach to things. But again, I think the overall consideration is whether how much is it actually going to cost you if this code actually fails. And that's, you know, totally, it depends. Again, I mean, if you're just building some internal software for your human resource department, and maybe that's not, you know, very important that it always runs and, you know, it has, you know, it's always available. Maybe that's not important. Maybe you can get by if there's a, you know, a null reference exception now and then, and you can fix that when, you know, the bug
happens.
Yeah.
Right.
So in that case, it, you know, it may be overkill to unit test everything. But on the other hand, if you're building a big financial application and, you know, you're collecting tons of financial information from your customers and it's sitting in the wild or whatever, the cost of making a mistake is probably going to be pretty big. And then that would, you know, tell me that we probably need more test coverage here in one form or another.
So from that point of view, going back to the MVC example,
yes.
But it, you know, even it would seem like even in a, unless it's a very trivial application, it's important that a controller returns a view and things like that. You would probably want to test that pretty much always.
I think it makes sense to do that because, in many cases anyway, I think it makes sense to do that because what it enables you to do is it enables you to establish a flow through the application, if you will. So you can say at the controller level, you can say this controller method, this action method, as it's called in MVC, this action method actually kicks off the following data flow. So it takes some input, it mm-hmm. converts that input using some other, you know, mapper or whatever you want to have inside of that. And then it makes a query into some other injected repository interface to save something in a database. And then it returns, you know, a view result,
mm-hmm.
something like that. That's a data flow as I view it anyway. And you would, if you test that data flow using mux and stubs, you know that this is the interaction that this controller actually executes.
Okay.
And that means now you can go and visit all of those individual things that implement those interfaces and test those in isolation. And if you also have a test or some sort of verification process that says, well, when the controller is actually being composed, it actually gets composed with this specific implementation of the repository and this implementation of, you know, the mapper or whatever that is. That actually means that you have proven that, you know, all these small units have the correct behavior, and you have also proven that you actually compose those behaviors correctly together. So now you know that the entire system actually works as intended.
Okay.
So what it does is that if you have a complex system where you have lots of branches throughout your code, you know, lots of if then sentences, if then statements, you know, if you want to test, you know, all of that just from the outside, you'd have to have lots and lots and lots of test cases to cover all of those different ways through the code, because you would have lots of permutations you actually need to cover. So decomposing all of that into several small units that you can unit test in isolation cuts down on the number of permutations that you need to cover.
So, and I think you've answered my next question, which was, I was going to ask, you know, about specifically with web, a lot of, I see a lot of people talking about testing using Selenium or, you know, other things and doing kind of an outside in test.
Yes. So I think it's really, again, dependent on what sort of system are you actually building, because I totally agree that in the end, you're not building a system composed of units. You're building a system for your customer or whoever gave you the assignment, because that person cared about a specific behavior that this software is going to exhibit. So you really care about the external behavior of the software and not the units, really. So if you can get by and just, you know, cover the entire functionality of that system by just talking at the, you know, external boundary, that makes a lot of sense to me. But it's just, as the complexity of the system grows, you may have to throw so many test cases at your external boundary that it becomes very difficult to maintain. And at that point, I think it makes sense to drop down at a lower level and start testing things in isolation.
Okay. That's probably about good. Is there anything else you wanted to cover before we wrap up?
Well, you know, as you can tell, I'm pretty easy to get started once I do get started. So, well, maybe we should just mention that some of the stuff that we've been talking about here is actually in my upcoming Pluralsight course. That's just going to be out maybe this week, maybe next week, I think.
Okay.
I actually uploaded all the content to Pluralsight already. So it's just in the review phase at the moment.
Great.
So if, you know, the listeners are interested in that, there's...
yeah, we'll have a link in the show notes.
Cool. That'd be nice.
Great. Okay. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.